Adam Johnson.
I can't even parse through. That's like so many layers. No, I understand what you're saying. It's she's like reaching really far to be mad at the left. You got to reach really far.
It's really offensive. It's like so disrespectful, not just of what the left in general is doing, but it's like of this person who was killed. I can't get over it. Then there's, you know, in terms of being really disingenuous, of course, there's a woman who said, she tweeted this morning, if the Bernie Bros wanted to make a show of force on behalf of progressive values, Saturday in Charlottesville would be a good time.
Sounds like one of them died, actually. So it sounds like the Bernie Bros kind of took one for the team.
Yeah, and they were Bernie sisters, too. That was Jack Smith, a Mike reporter, or reporter at Mike.com. And he was talking to me at Sunday, 1 a.m., about his experience at Charlottesville. Thanks so much for listening to the Katie Halper Show. You can hear us every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WBAI. That's 99.5 FM or WBAI.org.
Thank you, Katie. And as we approach the hour of 8 p.m. in just another minute and a half or so, you are listening to WBAI, that's 99.5 FM in New York. It's WBAI.org on the internet. And as we approach that hour, it's just about time for another exciting edition of Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. Now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse. But if they could, they would. Oh, Billy Bump for the best, expect the worst. I hope that's understood. But Billy Bow!
And a very good evening to you. This program is Off the Hook. Rob T. Firefly here with you. I am joined in the studio by Voltaire.
Hello.
And by Alex.
Good evening.
Our colleagues Emmanuel and Kyle are off chasing some sort of eclipse. I'm sure we'll hear more from them as that situation develops. But we are also joined by a special guest here in the studio today to talk about one of our stories. We are joined by Lorenzo Franceschi Bicarai from Motherboard at Vice. Lorenzo, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Excited to be here.
Well, we're so happy to have you here today, Lorenzo, because you've been doing some excellent reporting on something we've been covering for a little while now and that the world should be aware of, which is this malware tech arrest. And there's been some rather interesting developments since the beginning of this week. And I think for the benefit of some of our listeners who may perhaps have not been sober for the last couple of weeks, or maybe the conditions of their bail don't allow them to use a computer, so they may not be aware of what's been going on with malware tech. So I think we can just go into a little bit of background about who he is and, you know, what's going on here. And so this whole story seems to really have started last month, really. If you think about it, because there was an indictment for this security researcher that came down on 11 July. And the security researcher was made extremely famous the world over because he had identified a domain name that was essentially the off switch for the WannaCry or the WannaCrypt ransomware that was spreading globally through the world, shutting down hospitals at the NHS. And whether he liked it or not, the British tabloids identified who he was, and he became a sort of overnight celebrity. And then when he came over to the United States, ostensibly to attend DEF CON in Las Vegas, on his way out in McCarran Airport on 2 August, he was arrested by the FBI. Taken into custody, held, I think, for an extended period of time without an attorney present, had been interrogated. I presume his Miranda rights were read to him. And then on 4 August, there was an initial appearance at which bail was set. And those conditions of bail, I think they required $30,000 to be posted. And the conditions were actually quite onerous. He wasn't allowed to use a computer. And because of the late hour of the day, that was on a Friday, he wound up spending that weekend in jail, and he wasn't bailed out until Monday, which was 7 August. And then I believe not much had happened in this particular case until this past Monday in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, when he was arraigned. And we're very grateful to have you here, Lorenzo, because you were actually in Milwaukee, weren't you?
Yes, correct. I flew to Milwaukee on Sunday night and attended the hearing, which was Monday morning.
And how did you like Milwaukee, by the way?
I didn't have a chance to see too much of it, but it seemed like a nice town. Yeah. The weather was great.
Very diplomatic response.
Yeah, you know.
Very diplomatic. So tell us about this. So you flew into Milwaukee. You stayed in, you know, some kind of motel or something, you know, somewhere near the courthouse. You got up early in the morning, and you went to the Federal District Court for the Eastern District of Wisconsin. What's the courthouse like, by the way?
It's actually really nice. It's sort of like a kind of old-fashioned building with a bunch of, like, some towers. I guess it's pretty similar to the one in New York.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess they try to convey, you know, history with these buildings. And one of the things that surprised me actually about the court was that I was expecting not to be able to bring in any devices. Because as you know, in New York, courts, I think all courts in New York just take all your devices. Whereas in this particular court, they just asked me to turn in my camera, like my old-fashioned camera, and my old-fashioned recorder, but they allowed my phone.
That's
which I was like, okay, you guys realize that this is also a recorder and a camera. But that was, you know, that helped because I was able to bring in my laptop and take notes with that because my handwriting is terrible.
They actually let you bring a laptop in as a member of the public. That would never happen here in New York. I mean, and it's mostly the federal courts here in New York that make you deposit your devices with the federal marshals when you're going in. I'm not so sure, but I think state court will allow you basically to walk in with anything short of a shotgun these days. And if you have an attorney ID card, you can bring in really whatever the hell you want.
I think in that case they actually give you a gun if you don't have one already.
That's true. Well, you don't go through a metal detector, so it's rather interesting. So you get in there, it's this really kind of ornate, beautiful, old-school-looking courthouse that is a grand example of our tax dollars at work. And where were you sitting when you got into the courtroom?
So I got there pretty early, just in case I wanted to, you know, I didn't want to miss anything. So I sat outside and just waited until everyone. I was actually the first one to show up, which doesn't happen very often with me.
You are Italian.
Yeah, I'm Italian. I'm usually late. So yeah, I sat outside and I actually saw Marcus Hutchins, also known as MalwareTech, come in at some point, his lawyers, whom at the time actually were not known in the sense that in Nevada, he hired a local lawyer and now two new lawyers have taken over the case. So they showed up with him. His family was there. His mother and his brother were there. And there was a pretty sizable crew of journalists. Considering that, you know, it's sort of it's a big case in the hacking community, but it's probably not like something that mainstream journalists like would know or cover too much. Mostly it was like local journalists, me, and there was also Marcy Wheeler, also known as MT Wheel, who traveled there as well to follow the case. Well,
that's interesting, too. You know, you bring up an interesting point, I think, because, you know, when the story broke, I think you and Motherboard were actually the first organizations to break it. Is that right?
Yeah, when Hutchins or MalwareTech was arrested, my colleague Joseph Cox broke the story. So we were the ones to basically reveal that he was detained. And at the time, actually, we didn't even know why. Like when we reported that he had been detained, all we knew was that he had been stopped at the airport.
A lot of people will probably agree with that even still today. They don't know why he's being detained. If you actually read that indictment really closely like we did last week, sort of like the Micro Machine Man. So you get in there, you see Marcus Hutchins, you see MalwareTech. What was his demeanor like when you saw him when he was with his family?
He seemed pretty calm, and he didn't seem, you know, too nervous or, you know, spooked or anything like that. He seemed to be very calm. The whole hearing was very, very short. I think it lasted, you know, around 30 minutes. And what struck me the most during the hearing was how friendly everything was. Because in the previous hearing in Nevada, the one on August 4th, the prosecution tried to essentially convince the judge not to give bail and not to, you know, not to let Hutchins out. And their arguments were that, you know, he's a suspected criminal. And one of the most controversial arguments was that he had, like, shot a bunch of guns and machine guns and shotguns and whatever.
I mean, it's
in
Las Vegas. That's what everybody does over there, right?
Yeah, which was the answer of his lawyer, and the judge didn't buy it. You know, the judge was like, you know, this is posted, you know, at the airport there are advertisements for it. This is ridiculous. So, but you know, but in Milwaukee, on the other hand, the prosecutor just seemed to give the defense whatever they wanted in terms of conditions for bail. The defense lawyers were like, we want him to get out. We want him to be able to travel in the United States, which was granted. We wanted to be able to live in Los Angeles, which is, you know, pretty far from Milwaukee, but neither the judge nor the prosecution seemed to care about that. And most importantly, and which I think was also most surprisingly, they allowed him back on the internet, which, as far as I know, it's kind of strange for a hacking case.
Yeah, that is really very unique. I mean, I guess it's part and parcel with his job and his ability to make a living, and I'm not sure if that was brought up. But I'm quite surprised that the prosecution at DOJ didn't press back on that. That it's sort of weird to me, and I'm not sure if you can shed any light on this, but he's allowed on the internet, but he's not allowed to access the sinkhole or the domain name that he uncovered when he was analyzing the source code of WannaCrypt that ended up being the sort of the kill switch. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. That's basically the only condition that the government seemed to be interested in, which is very interesting because WannaCry, as far as we know today, doesn't have anything to do with the case itself. So, yeah, in court, basically, the prosecutor was like, we're going to allow him back on the internet with one exception. He cannot access the sinkhole of WannaCry. And so, yeah, basically, the government doesn't want him to have any access to that anymore.
I mean, it's such a weird condition. I mean, what did they think they were going to? I guess there wasn't much talk about this on the record, but did they think he was going to deactivate the domain name and allow WannaCrypt to, you know, spawn again? I mean, that's the only thing I could think of.
Yeah, I mean, we can only speculate.
Maybe they're doing some investigative work just because of the geopolitical implications of WannaCry. Maybe they're still trying to find out, like, the causes of it and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, they could have set one of the conditions to transfer ownership of the domain to the FBI. I'm sure the defense would have granted it.
Yeah,
it's pretty interesting. He returned to Twitter on August 14th, but as he's mentioned there, he really can't do much. He can't speak about the case or anything that he's going through, so he's basically telling jokes and talking about generic infosec stuff. But his first tweet when he returned was, things to do during DEF CON: attend parties, visit Red Rock Canyon, go shooting, be indicted by the FBI, rent supercars.
Exactly. I saw that too. I mean, it's amazing that he still has a sense of humor about this when he's facing these, you know, really serious charges. One of the things that we went into last week in the show that is still, I think, a mystery for everybody on this planet and elsewhere is this unnamed co-conspirator. I guess he's not an unindicted co-conspirator because he's in the indictment. He's just unnamed. And was there any discussion about this whatsoever?
No, there was no discussion. Unfortunately, that they didn't talk about it at all. You know, maybe when the prosecutor and the defense lawyers met beforehand, before the hearing, they talked about it. But on the record, in front of the judge, there was no mention of the co-defendant Monday.
Well, it's interesting too. And I actually don't remember if we brought this up last week. But if you look at the indictment right here, you know, it says, you know, under it starts off with defendants and then defendant and then it's redacted. Well, that's paragraph A, and then paragraph B names Marcus Hutchins or Malware Tech, but defendant who is unnamed and you know redacted from the indictment. It's a really long redaction. I mean, it's about an entire line. So either this person has an extraordinarily lengthy name, or they have a lengthy alias, or perhaps more likely they have several aliases. And you know, yesterday there was some weird stuff that happened with respect to Pacer. Do you know anything about this, Lorenzo?
Yeah, as many other things in this story, we don't know too much about it. But basically what happened is that at some point, either yesterday or 2 days ago, in Pacer, the public system to check court documents in the U.S., something changed. Like the name of the defendant in the case changed. So instead of being U.S. V. Hutchins, it became U.S. V. Tran. And someone, a couple of people on Twitter noticed it and, you know, were puzzled by it. And we can only speculate again. Maybe someone at Pacer or someone at the DOJ made a mistake and, you know, unwillingly revealed the name of the other defendant. Maybe it's some sort of glitch or bug. Who knows? For now, DOJ is not talking about it.
So they're not talking about it. I mean, Tran is only four characters, T-R-A-N. I mean, unless there was some kind of full justification error, it wouldn't take up that entire line. But it is really weird, right? I mean, because we have Hutchins et alia. It's United States v. Hutchins et alia, which is, you know, and others. It's really quite possible that a clerk who was changing something or rearranging the docket or putting in minute entries or something may have accidentally switched the names of the defendants and put it on there and it changed the caption. I don't really know how Pacer works. I do know it's really old and stale and, you know, fraught with all kinds of ridiculous problems, one of which is that it charges you for every single damn thing that you do on it. I mean, it's such a weird mystery. I'm trying to, you know, well, I'm sure we'll unriddle this in the weeks to come. But so there was no discussion about the unnamed co-conspirator there. I mean, I think that's interesting as well. What about Milwaukee itself? Was there any discussion about why you were in Wisconsin?
Also, no discussion of that in the hearing on Monday. But just to go back quickly to the co-defendant, all we know about him or her at this point is that the prosecutors in Las Vegas at the hearing the week prior said that it's still at large or still, you know, uncaught. He hasn't been or she hasn't been caught, which is interesting. And it's kind of like the only thing we know on the record.
Yeah, I'm curious also about, like, suspicious about why he was in Milwaukee. My initial suspicion is that the FBI was trying to, like, shop for a friendly judge. With the CFAA, maybe you can explain this more, Alec, but they can basically claim that because computers across the world are connected, you can claim that anybody is a victim of the CFAA, which is why we have a non-American citizen being tried in the U.S.
Yeah, I think it's a possibility. I think it's more likely that there's some sort of nexus to Milwaukee or the Eastern District of Wisconsin. The unnamed co-conspirator may, you know, reside there. Something may have happened there. I think there's probably something going on there because there's plenty of friendly judges to the Department of Justice these days, and you know they could have chosen anywhere. If they would have chosen anywhere, I mean, you know, there's really sophisticated judges here in New York in the Southern District that deal a lot with the CFAA and technology. And if I were DOJ, I would probably want to bring it in a forum like the SDNY, the Southern District here in New York, where judges have a lot of familiarity with these types of technical issues, or maybe even possibly somewhere like the Eastern District of Texas, where all the patent claims are brought.
Not anymore.
That's true. That has changed, but they're still being filed there, believe it or not.
Wow.
And you know, these counts too. I mean, we go back to the indictment. It does seem, you know, really flimsy. And as far as I know, there was no real discussion about the indictment either. Is that, you know, another thing that's still a bit of a black hole as to the government's real theory of this case?
Yeah, unfortunately, they also didn't talk about it at all, other than, you know, the judge reading the charges and Hutchins' lawyer saying not guilty.
The judge didn't laugh when they were reading any of the charges or snicker or anything?
No, no hints like that. The only funny moment in the hearing was when the prosecutor mentioned that Hutchins couldn't access the sinkhole, and the judge seemed very puzzled. And after a little pause, he was like, okay, can you guys please repeat, you know, what is that sinkhole? I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, really? No clue, the sinkhole. Yep. That's interesting. Yeah, and you know, so this whole thing took about 30 minutes. At the end of it, I guess, yeah, Marcus Hutchins was probably pretty happy with the result.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's hard to tell what he thought, but I think that for the defense, this was a good day. You know, they got him, they improved his bail conditions, which, as you said, were pretty strict. And essentially, he's a free man, except for the fact that, you know, he'll have to be back in court.
That's right. I imagine he still doesn't have a passport as well.
There was some discussion about that. I think they will return his passport at some point so that he can travel within the U.S., but obviously he cannot leave the U.S.
Oh, he can't leave the U.S. I mean, if he could get to Morocco, there's no extradition treaties. Just saying.
I think we've come a long way with since the days of Kevin Mitnick, when the judges said that he couldn't get bail because he could blow whistle into a phone and start a nuclear war.
Yeah, so. I think that's right. Yeah. So what happened at the conclusion of the proceedings? You know, the judge, it's a magistrate judge, I think, right? So it's not a federal district court judge, it's a federal magistrate judge. It deals with a lot of, the only difference being between those two is that the magistrate judge deals with a lot of the administrative issues and discovery disputes, things like that. Of course, there was, I guess, a trial date set.
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, the trial date was set for October 23rd. But my understanding is that, and there was some mention of it at the hearing itself, is that there's a chance that this might get delayed.
Yeah, I can't imagine this going to trial so quickly. I mean, this is a really complicated case. They haven't located the unnamed co-defendant. You know, just the exchange of discovery in this case is going to take a long time. And that's another issue, too. So pretrial motions, discovery, exchanges of documents, anything like that, that was discussed on the record?
No, not really. Other than the dates, not really.
That's interesting. I mean, I would be shocked if October 23rd came around and there was actually a trial starting. They concluded the proceedings and people were happy. They left the courtroom. There wasn't too many members of the media there. So was there a press conference or anything, you know, on the courthouse steps, anything dramatic?
The prosecutors left, the one prosecutor left with no, you know, without talking or anything. He basically just, you know, escaped the room as soon as quick as possible. Hutchins' lawyers, on the other hand, did come out and release a very short statement. And by the way, the lawyer, his lawyers are Marsha Hoffman and Brian Klein. They both came out and they also released a very short statement. They just basically just said that Hutchins is a hero and like a very respected security researcher, and they'll fight, you know, he will fight these charges.
Yeah, Marsha Hoffman used to be with the EFS, so she's really top-notch in these issues.
Yeah, no question. I've seen her speak at DEF CON and various places. She's a great attorney. She's a good person. I think he's in very good hands here. And then after everything concluded, they left the building and they just sort of went their separate ways, and you went back to the airport?
Yeah, essentially that's kind of what happened. But I think it was interesting. I mean, you know, just to again to highlight it, I think that the change in tone in the government's change of tone is the big takeaway of the hearing on Monday. You know, whereas in Nevada the prosecutor was trying to paint Hutchins as some sort of like dangerous, young, like reckless guy that could, you know, take a gun and shoot someone. The prosecutor in Milwaukee was basically just like, yeah, you know, sure, he can go back to work. He should, you know, he can go back to the internet, Twitter, whatever, as long as he doesn't touch WannaCry. Yeah. It was just very, very strange.
Yeah, it's a big change. I mean, I guess there's a big difference between Vegas and the Midwest. Maybe it's just that Midwestern charm and sensibility. Even DOJ prosecutors have assimilated that into their everyday life. You know, perhaps, we don't know. I do have to ask you about something else, though, because I saw on your Twitter feed that you had this, you know, really interesting picture of Marcus Hutchins.
Yeah, so since I was able to take the phone into the courtroom while we were waiting outside, you know, for the clerks to let us in, I noticed that Hutchins was sitting with Marsha Hoffman at the table, and they were just chatting, I guess. And I could see them because there was a door with like a little window. And so I thought, well, I'll take a picture. You know, I'm a journalist and then a writer. I'm also supposed to take pictures once in a while. And I posted it on Twitter. And I later heard that maybe that was against the rules of the court. Let's put it that way.
I think so. Yes. Yeah. I was going to say you could take the fifth here. Yeah. But who
knows?
Yeah,
maybe I should.
Yeah, they may recognize you the next time you go back to the Eastern District of Wisconsin over there. They're not going to let you bring anything in. Now, I mean, who knows? It's a great photo, though. You took that with an iPhone?
Yeah.
Fantastic. What's the passcode to your iPhone?
I'll send it to you.
You were about to tell me anything, so yeah.
I've already got it, actually. I'll give it to you later.
You've got it. Fantastic. That is a great picture, and I was really surprised. I said, wow. He's got some balls on him. He's taking pictures in a federal court over there. That's amazing. You know, he's really going at it. I mean, this is such a fascinating story, though. And I think, you know, when we see it unfold over the next weeks and months, you know, I really just want to know what the hell is the theory of the government? And it's so disappointing that we don't really have much more insight after the arraignment here. Oh, and by the way, I guess the most important point of the arraignment we completely skipped over. Did he plead something?
Yes, he pled not guilty.
Of course,
charges,
right. Yeah, we wouldn't be talking about it, I guess, right? But these charges, they're kind of weird, and I think we could go into them after Voltaire says something.
Yeah, on the topic of going into them, if you look at the wording, they don't charge him with, like, raiding the Kronos malware. They charge him with the software that would later become, is the exact quote. And if you ask me, that sounds like it could have just been, an open-source library that he wrote and put on his GitHub, and then they found that was incorporated, and now they're charging him with that. Which would have very serious negative repercussions for security researchers, like, who are releasing open source code all the time that can be used for malware. Somebody retweeted a tweet of him from around 2014, where he basically said the same thing, like, oh, I found a piece of malware that's using a piece of my code. It pissed me off, but, like, what can I do about it?
But if you were responsible for it, wouldn't you do that, too? Wouldn't you want to have something on the record, Voltaire, that indicates your innocence way back in the day?
True.
True, yes. Perhaps. Now, but I think you raise a good point here, too, though, because if you look at count one of the indictment, which is this conspiracy to cause damage to a computer, it's kind of a strange thing here. And I do have to say, Orrin Kerr, who's a professor at GW, wrote a really great piece for The Washington Post, which, you know, like Motherboard, has been really knocking it out of the park lately in terms of their stories, in particular with respect to Trump and Russia, of course. But this whole notion of the conspiracy to damage a computer, as Orrin Kerr pointed out in this article, what they're doing, really, and why this indictment does appear to be quite flimsy, is conflating the sale of malware or the sale of a program with its actual use. I mean, nobody said that he used anything whatsoever. And that's the first count in the indictment. And the sixth count also, which is the conspiracy to damage a computer, has the same issue. They're conflating the sale of something together with the actual use. So I think that's a real problem here. And as you mentioned, Voltaire, there's going to be a spillover effect in terms of the security researcher community. People are going to be very reluctant to cooperate with the government. They're going to be reluctant to go to cons. We've got the Circle of Hope coming up next year, and we're going to have a lot of very reluctant people who may be hesitant to come to the United States because they don't know if there's a sealed indictment waiting for them. You know, when they go back to JFK, are they going to be picked up like Marcus Hutchins was at McCarran Airport?
Meanwhile, this whole thing, as we touched on last week when we reported on his initial arrest, it just all seems very weird. I mean, now we go into the indictment, and it seems like they're not really sure what they're indicting him for. When they picked him up, it was they let him go to a conference, apparently followed him around, waited till it was over, and got him at the airport waiting for his flight home, which happened to be delayed. So just so many elements of this don't seem like your standard straightforward case of the government wanting someone and picking him up and going for it.
It's certainly not straightforward. I mean, it's downright unusual, too. I mean, let's very briefly talk about the other remaining counts, because I think our listeners will find this somewhat interesting. And again, it's something that Oren Kerr went into in his article. But counts 2, 3, and 4, count 2 really has to do with advertising for some sort of wiretapping device. That's the violation of the law that is specified in count 2. Count 3 has to deal with sending a wiretapping device across state lines. And of course, everything has to be across state lines because we're dealing with a federal indictment here as opposed to something that's just at the state level. And count 4 has to deal with selling a wiretapping device through interstate commerce. So device is a really interesting word here, right? Because, you know, they are treating, first of all, malware, number one, as a wiretapping type of incident, which has been the case in the past. Spyware and things have been have constituted wiretapping type devices. But this issue of device, there have been cases in the past where wiretapping devices have been spyware that have been installed on people's phones without their consent. And since it captures keystrokes or it captures communications, they're violating the federal wiretapping statutes. But those cases always had software running on a device. Here we just have source code, unconnected, divorced, out there in the ether, arguably uncompiled source code constituting a device. And I ask you guys, can source code be a device? I mean, what do you think about this?
It's really bizarre to think of it. I mean, if we were to draw some kind of analogy for maybe people who aren't so elbow deep in InfoSec, it's like posting a recipe online for your favorite pizza, and then someone somewhere in the world makes that pizza, whomps someone over the head with it, gets hauled away to jail for assault, and the person who posted the recipe is now somehow at fault for that assault.
I think that's actually a pretty good analogy.
Yeah, I thought we had moved past this in the 90s when we stopped treating encryption and stuff as munitions.
Yeah, I mean, perhaps it's an odd thing, you know, and there's going to be a lot of fallout here, because if source code can constitute a device, who's going to develop anything that could arguably violate the federal wiretapping statute? I mean, you've probably been in contact with a lot of people on this subject, Lorenzo. You know, are you seeing any kind of, you know, major fallout, you know, issues of distrust, reluctance?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when the arrest was reported, a lot of people were outraged just because Hutchins is such a popular figure. But then when the indictment was published and people could finally see what he was accused of, it was even worse. You know, everyone was like, well, wait a second, you know, am I going to be indicted because I create some sort of, like, you know, some strings of code that eventually someone else that I have no knowledge of will use for bad actions and to make some money. And there were a lot of people that were outspoken about it. There was another UK researcher called Kevin Beaumont who blogged, he published a blog post saying, I'm not going to collaborate with GCHQ anymore because of this case. He essentially said, you know, I used to share intelligence on threats and attacks with GCHQ because of the uncertainty surrounding this, as a symbolic gesture of support and protest, I'm going to stop. There was also Rob Graham, another, like, pretty well-known security researcher. You might follow him on Twitter. His handle is Errata Rob. He also essentially said, you know, I wrote malware in the past for work many times. You know, if someone picks it up and writes ransomware or something like that, am I going to go to jail too?
Yeah, it's really amazing, and there's real danger of a chilling effect here. We're already seeing effects of that when other respected members of the security community start to withdraw from what they do, because they're now feeling unsafe in their vocation because of what's happening to Hutchins. The open source community and the open source programming world is decades old now. There is so much code out there over the years that so many uncountable people have written. Are people who wrote some fragment of something 20 years ago now going to be at fault if something gets used that used code that from something that used code from something that used code that they might have written when they were a kid?
Well, you're right, but this could make people really nervous. I mean, and I'm sure people are really nervous about this. It's a very strange thing too, because you know, intent obviously is a core component of any kind of criminal offense. And any criminal offense, you have two components. You have the mens rea, or the mental element, the intent, and the actus reus, the actual act here. And in this indictment, both of them seem to somewhat really be lacking, because if you look at count six, they seem to indicate or drop a couple of hints that what they're talking about here is an attempt, a conspiracy to damage computers that was really an attempt. It's not really clear that that's their theory, but you know, it's the word attempt is in count six. And with respect to all of these, if he is being indicted solely on the basis that he created some kind of malware, that he wrote the source code for it, then a critical component of any criminal charge is going to be his intent to have that used in a malicious manner when he first created it as well. Or perhaps they could proceed on an alternate theory, which is he either knew that it would be used as in a malicious way, or should have known that it was going to be used in a malicious way. And if it is the latter, well, that's really scary too, because that's going to have the same chilling effect that we had just discussed on the show. Because knew or should have known, I mean, that puts a lot of people at jeopardy.
It's definitely a whole lot to think about, Voltaire.
Oh no.
Okay, not that much to think about, I guess. We'll talk about some other things, but our guest will be sticking around. Lorenzo, let me make an attempt at this again. Franceschi Bicarai.
Perfect.
Excellent. And of course, people can find you on Twitter at Lorenzo FB.
Mm-hmm.
People can also find Marcus Hutchins on Twitter and the interesting things he's posting about Malware Tech Blog on Twitter, and right now it paints a picture of a guy who's keeping a good sense of humor despite being really inconvenienced by his situation.
And if you have any questions for us about the case, you can tweet us at Hacker Radio Show.
At Hacker Radio Show on Twitter. Couple other things going on in the world, many other things going on in the world, but in our particular wheelhouse here, also a couple of other things going on in the world. One of them, talking of chilling effects, there was a story by our pals at Torrent Freak about the DMCA being used to remove an ad server URL from the EasyList ad block list. EasyList, which is an ad block filter used by millions of subscribers, appears to be under attack. GitHub, where the project is hosted, received a DMCA notice requiring a domain URL to be removed from that list. For those unfamiliar, these are the addresses that this list collects addresses of basically advertising malware, things people might not want to load in their browsers, so they engage these filters to filter out the sites on the list. But the owners of one of these sites basically used the DMCA to get their URL removed from the list. The commit appeared in the EasyList repo on GitHub a few days ago, and it was. Let's see, it was added with the comment, removed due to DMCA takedown request, and it was for the domain functionalclam.com.
Right, yes, that's right.
Filtering out things from functionalclam.com. Apparently whoever's in charge of that site really wanted to get off of that list and decided to use the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Now, Alex, how does this smell from a legal standpoint?
I mean, it's really odd. I've never seen the DMCA used in this way. And on the other hand, you know, to be fair, I think it's really quite innovative. I give kudos to the lawyer who drafted that request. Like, nothing was filed in court. It was just a DMCA request, right? I mean, that's my understanding.
Well, GitHub received it and then told them they took down the repo if they didn't remove it.
Oh, which, is that right?
Which also speaks to the wider implications of, like, having a lot of open source projects are development done through GitHub and using them as a centralized repo of source code. And that's like very problematic now that GitHub is like basically censoring things. They could have fought this. A lot of tech companies do a good job of fighting back against egregious DMCA notifications. And this certainly seems like one of them. But in this case, it looks like GitHub did not do that.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is just really a sort of strange thing to use the DMCA for. It's odd, it's innovative, and it seems to have worked. I mean, I imagine that they probably made some sort of normal attempt to have their domain name removed from this ban list. Or did they just go full bore with a DMCA takedown request? I mean, that I don't know.
The company that sent the request is, they just shoot blanket requests for like lots of right holders, so they probably don't even have the time to do this.
Yeah, the who is for the domain functional clam is hidden, but a user of GitHub basically sleuthed out that it's apparently operated by an anti-ad blocking company called Admiral. There is also a username that popped up on GitHub commenting on a commit, username DMCA helper. Which commented the filter above added to easylist@servers.txt has been reported to circumvent copyright access controls. Please remove to avoid file or repository disruption. For more information on GitHub's DMCA takedown policy, see, and there's a link. But this was a newly registered user account, not apparently something from GitHub staff or anything like that. So it's an unusual way for this to be used. And what do you think? Could something like this stick?
I think so. I think it could. I mean, it's definitely going. It seemed to have worked, right?
Yeah, but this so. When this list is this list consists of a list of domain names, basically a directory. How does that jive with the claim of copyright infringement? Can someone own a copyright on their domain name and choose it to be removed from a directory?
I mean, that's an interesting question, because if a domain name is content, then perhaps yes. Now, functional clam. I don't really know if that's a copyrightable term. That's actually an open issue. But yeah, if your domain name is essentially creating some sort of content, then arguably you would have a copyright to it. But yeah, functional clam. I mean, look, these guys are innovative. They have DMCA helper elves, I guess, running all around GitHub, making takedown requests. I mean, this is an odd story. I think people are probably going to wake up to the fact that the DMCA can be used in many different ways on account of this story. And we'll probably see this more often.
Even if the DMCA can be used, can consider domain names as copyright, then this domain name should also still be qualified as fair use.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially if it's used to critique or criticize something like that, then definitely it should constitute fair use. Absolutely.
I'd imagine adding a domain to an anti-spam list is a form of criticism.
Yeah, what's really odd too is that in the usual sphere of IP protection when it comes to domain names, you're not really dealing with copyright at all. You're always dealing with trademarks. And that's what ICANN has taken great pains since the late 90s to establish the UDRP, or the Uniform Domain Name Resolution Policy, whereby arbitrations are initiated with either the National Arbitration Forum or the World Intellectual Property Organization to take down domain names that are infringing on other people's IP. And we file these types of UDRPs on behalf of our clients all the time. We never, of course, trample on people's fair use rights. That would be a bad thing to do. Not the best way to win friends and influence people in this community, no doubt. But yeah, we're generally dealing with trademark. We're not generally dealing with copyright. So yeah, this is an innovative thing. And I mean, I'm always happy to see innovative uses of the law, but this one seems like it could be particularly damaging.
Our friends at the EFF have already reached out to the parties involved, so hopefully we'll have a positive update soon.
In the meantime, I don't think anything's stopping users from using some sort of local filtering to block out functionalclam.com from their travels, but I may get in trouble for suggesting that now.
I bet, yeah. Hey, can we talk about this story with the Ukrainian consultant to the Russians? What do you say, Rob?
Absolutely.
Because I think there's some interesting crossover between that story and what happened with MalwareTech, or at least some interesting comparisons to be made. Do you want to give some background on it? Do you want me to give some background on it? How do you want to do it? Okay, all right, I guess. So the New York Times, I believe it is, came out with a story When did this story come out? Was it
today?
Today. It was today. Interesting. Okay. I read it earlier today, so yeah, I'm right on top of things. This is unusual.
Fingers on the pulse. That's us.
I also have Italian heritage, so I'm usually late and behind the times. You know how it is, Lorenzo.
Yeah, it comes with the blood, I guess.
Exactly. So this is a very interesting story because they've broken some sort of news about what appears to be a consultant, some sort of malware consultant who had done what Hutchins was alleged to have done, which is create some kind of malware or provide some sort of source code that was then used to hack the DNC. And as far as we can tell from the story, this source code also seemed to have popped up in 2014 in an election hack of the Ukrainian national election. And so you compare the source code of the malware, and there are certain, I guess, I don't know, they don't go into the technical details of exactly what it is that was contained in the Ukrainian election hack in 2014 and what was contained in the DNC hack, I guess, for obvious reasons. But Ukraine, according to this article, appears to be some sort of staging center for Russian hacks these days. And, you know, it's like a proving ground or a testing ground for their types of malware. And what's rather interesting with this particular case is this consultant didn't really know that he was working for the Russians. So this gives us some insight as to the MO of the Russian intelligence services, that they're willing to essentially hire freelancers, hire consultants, find anything, anywhere that could be used against a potential target. We also saw this actually in another somewhat related story, because this has to deal with, you know, APT-28 or Fancy Bear, as it's known. And there was an earlier story earlier, I guess it was last week, about Fancy Bear targeting hotel guests using Eternal Blue, which was disclosed by the shadow brokers and originally developed by the NSA. So yeah, the Russians are pretty resourceful. They'll find people and they will employ them, and they may not know that they're working for them. But as it turns out, this particular consultant pieced together the puzzle after the fact and realized that what he had done was help hack the DNC, quite likely on behalf of the Russians. So it's a sort of odd thing that happened. He turned himself, well, he went dark first, if I recall correctly, and then he turned himself into the Ukrainian authorities. And here's the really weird thing, is that the Ukrainian authorities didn't arrest him. He developed this malware. It was used to hack the U.S. election. And they didn't arrest him because it's a sort of gray area of the law. And he developed the malware, but he didn't use it. So there's a big, kind of, there's a real distinction between how these types of people are treated in Ukraine and how they're treated in the United States.
Well, also, the reason why he wasn't arrested is because he turned himself in and he's cooperating with them. So,
oh, you could still be arrested too, right? I mean, don't kid yourself out there, right? I think his cooperation definitely has something to do with it. It's also neat too that he went to Ukrainian authorities. I mean, he could have possibly just walked into the U.S. embassy and cooperated with U.S. authorities, but I think he felt probably more comfortable going to the Ukrainian authorities. But I mean, this is a case that I think has some interesting parallels with the malware tech case. And it gives us a lot of insight as to what's going on with Russia. And this is the first person who is, this is the first piece of evidence, which happens to be a person that can provide testimony and evidence and documentation as to who contacted him, how they did it, you know, how long it lasted, what was he paid, all of this. So, you know, how this plays out over the next couple of weeks and months is going to be really fascinating.
Yeah, I think this was definitely a story that sort of came out of the blue. And as you said, I think the most interesting thing is that finally we have a person, you know, even though like his role seems to be sort of like, you know, on the fringes of the hack, he doesn't seem to be, it doesn't look like he was, you know, had an incredibly important role in the whole DNC hack. But I guess that's why, you know, his knowledge is so interesting that the FBI wants to talk to him.
Another interesting aspect is how it illustrates how decentralized the Russian hacking effort is. They rely on, like, outside malware distributors, whereas in the U.S., like, the FBI won't even employ somebody that, or not the FBI, but like the security services, like the NSA and folks won't even employ people that like smoke weed. So like, totally different style.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, they're very resourceful, and you know, this brings up an interesting question too. I mean, this whole story is geared towards, you know, this individual. I guess his name was Profexor, or his alias was Profexor, and he was very well known, I guess, in the malware sort of dark web community in Ukraine and Eastern Europe, as somebody who was highly respected. I wonder, you know, is there any real connection to Russia, though, or is it hypothetical? I mean, because, you know, we're all operating on the assumption, and it may be an erroneous assumption, that he was working directly for the Russians. The Russians could have employed a third party who then hired this guy as a freelancer. This could have gone through five or six third parties before it ended up, before the traces of it ended up in the DNC hack. You know, we just don't really know. And I think there probably were intermediaries here. I don't think that the Russians are so naive as to just, you know, hire a freelancer directly. There probably had to be some sort of proprietary corporation or organization that was hiring this person, because if they were doing it directly, I seriously doubt that they would not keep him on a really tight leash. If this was somebody who could provide critical evidence about the DNC hack, why is he walking into the police station voluntarily? Why was he able to go dark, evade detection, and walk into the Ukrainian police station and provide this evidence, which is the basis of the New York Times story?
Also, I think it's kind of fascinating that, you know, given the fact, as you said, that Ukraine has become some sort of a testing ground for Russian cyber attacks, and not just, you know, not just cyber attacks, there's basically a war going on there. It's interesting to think that they thought it was a good idea to tap into someone from Ukraine. I mean, who knows about his politics? Maybe he's a pro-Russian Ukrainian. But it's just like, it's fascinating to see that in Russian intelligence is willing to go into enemy territory to get knowledge and skills.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think, too, if we go back to the malware tech case, the Marcus Hutchins case, if he's cooperating with the United States and he's providing evidence here, and this also goes back to what you had mentioned, Voltaire, if he developed this malware, then shouldn't he, or rather, I guess I shouldn't say shouldn't, but couldn't he then also be charged with the same exact types of crimes that Marcus Hutchins is being charged with right now?
Yeah, and how much voluntary help from the security community are the powers that be basically cutting off by continuing along these lines? Anyway, it's a very interesting story, and we're definitely keeping an eye on that. We have a little bit of time left. I want to maybe try and take a couple of phone calls. You can reach us on the air, 347-335-0818. That's 347-335-0818, and we'll see if we can squeeze a couple of you in. While we're waiting for the board to light up, I'll read a listener email. Angelo writes, "You didn't mention Trump on your July 19th show. Congratulations, you resisted being trolled by the president for an entire show."
Well, now we just mentioned it. I think wasn't he happy about that? Now we read his story, and now we mentioned Trump.
We just mentioned who?
Exactly.
Oh, Trump.
I don't think we mentioned him by. Did we mention him by name in the show? Really?
I don't think we've mentioned Trump today. On it's been a Trump-free show. Although, if you're interested in Trump, you could tune into WBAI an hour and a half earlier before our show, and you can hear our colleagues at Trump Watch, our Trump-devoted show. Anyway, we have a call coming in. Let's see what they have on their mind. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Hey. Long-time listener, few-time caller. Glad to hear you guys. So far, the show is doing great.
Excellent. What's on your mind?
I just want to say hi. I also want to let you guys know it's been a long time. I really had a chance to listen to you guys again. It's nice hearing y'all. Nice hearing that the quality is still great, of course. Just wanted to plug out LaneChan.jp and to check out our LaneZine as well.
Excellent. Well, thank you for your call, and thank you for your
no
kind
problem,
words.
No problem.
Man, that was cool. Everyone who's calling the show should basically, you know, can we arrange for everyone calling to just say a bunch of nice stuff about it?
It doesn't usually happen like that.
Well, no. We'll see who comes in next. 347-335-0818. I think that's my favorite caller in all the time I've been doing the show. There's a little more listener email. Pico writes, malware tech got pretty wrong casted. It seems cruel to see how quickly he became cast as the bad person. I feel it's safe to say some people collected some bank by help of his disclosure on the BitLocker Mirai, leading to a link on malwaretech.com talking about Mirai, which I'm sure you could search for and get hold of. Bonus, not necessarily air question. Well, now it's on the air, so deal with it. How about Reality Winner? She got her story buried pretty quickly.
Well, actually, a story just came out that she turned out that the election workers that whose machines were targeted did not know about this until the story came out. And like when the story came out, lots of people were, like naysayers were saying like, "Oh, this is so inconsequential." Like, quote unquote, everybody knew that the rest were hacking, but the fact that they attested to not knowing about this, the people affected, and that, and it's also strange that the security community, the intelligence community, would keep it secret from the election workers, which kind of speaks to the overclassification.
Interesting. Well, we're the switchboard is decidedly dark at the moment, so I'll quickly mention this other news story that I thought was very interesting. It's from Wired. A group of researchers from the University of Washington has shown for the first time that it's possible to encode malicious software into physical strands of DNA, so that when a gene sequencer analyzes it, the resulting data becomes a program that corrupts gene sequencing software and takes control of the underlying computer. This is so cyberpunk. While that attack is far from practical for any real spy or criminal, it's one of the researchers argue could become more likely over time as DNA sequencing becomes more commonplace, powerful, and performed by third-party services on sensitive computer systems. You could have malware encoded into your very DNA.
It's true, actually. And in fact, you know, we actually deal with some clients that deal with DNA sequencing. And you know, sometimes, you know, DNA sequencing is shared between third parties, so it is quite possible that one could decide to infect another. You know, through the sharing of this particular type of DNA sequencing. So I saw that story. I thought it was really fascinating. I'm glad you brought it up. I want to bring up one other question to Lorenzo, too, while we still have a couple of minutes.
Sure.
The Reality Winner story and how it sort of dissipated into nothingness is what made me think of this. But, you know, you were in Milwaukee on Monday. Things are arguably going to keep happening in Milwaukee. Do you know if you're going to keep going back? Is Motherboard going to send you back to Wisconsin?
Yeah, I think that's the plan. As long as you know, there's nothing or there's no other like crazy story going on, and we can afford to have me there, I think that's the idea. We broke the story and we followed the story pretty closely. And I think that the main argument for us paying attention to this is not just that the case is interesting itself, is that as we explained in this show, it's just, you know, it could be a very dangerous precedent if all of a sudden people that just write code get ensnared in criminal charges because someone else picks it up and uses it, that could open up Pandora's box. And more to that point, this just seems to be a story where we don't know the most important points and the most important parts yet.
Yeah, that's right. It's going to be teased out. Well, we hope that you guys continue to do some excellent reporting on it. We're so happy that you broke this story. It really had a spillover effect, and lots of people are following this. Our listeners are following it. And you're a man with a lot on your plate as well. I don't know how you write so prolifically every week. You seem to have really interesting stories coming out. Keep up the good work, Lorenzo, and we're so happy to have had you here this evening. Thank you so much for coming in and spending some time with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Absolutely. We've been speaking with Lorenzo Franceschi Bicarai from Vice Motherboard at motherboard.vice.com is the web address where you can find this. We can find you on Twitter at LorenzoFB. Anywhere else you would like to, our listeners to know about where they can find your work? And
yeah, that's all. And like I have all, you know, if anyone has any suggestions or tips, they're all welcome. You can find always to contact me on via Twitter.
Excellent. Well, we'll wrap things up here. It's been an interesting episode. We'll definitely keep an eye on the stories we've talked about. Send us email with your thoughts, oth@2600.com. Get us on Twitter, Hacker Radio Show, and just keep doing what you do in interesting ways. For Off the Hook, this is Rob T. Firefly. Have a very good week.
Have you heard it on the news about this fascist group thing? Evil men with racist views spreading all across the land. Don't just sit there on your ass.
chain dance. Brother, sister, shoot your best. We don't need this fascist groove thing.
Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist groove thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist groove thing.
History will repeat itself. Crisis points, we're near the hour. Counterforce will do no good. Hard to ask, I feel your power. Hitler proves that funky stuff. It's not for you and me, girl.
No, no, no.
Europe's an unhappy land. They've had their fascist groove thing.
Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist groove thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist groove thing.
Democrats are out of power across that blue wide ocean. Reagan's president-elect, fascist god in motion. Generals tell him what to do. Stop your good time dancing. Train their guns on me and you. Fascist gang advancing. Sisters, brothers, lend a hand. Increase our population. Grab that blue thing by the throat and throw it in the ocean. You're real tonight, you move my soul. Let's cruise on the dance floor. Come out your house and dance your dance. Shake that fascist groove thing. Shake it.
Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist groove thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist groove thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist groove thing. Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist groove thing.
Advisory Board for WBAI will hold its regular meeting on Sunday, August 20th from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. in the atrium lobby of Deutsche Bank, 60 Wall Street in New York City. The CAB is a volunteer group of interested listeners who meet monthly to gather public comments and ideas as to whether the programming and policies of the station meet the specialized educational and cultural needs of the communities of Metro New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. The public is welcome, and we encourage WBAI listeners to make an effort to attend. Again, come out Sunday, August 20th, 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. at the Atrium Lobby at 60 Wall Street. Somebody go get up and speak in tongue tonight.
Today is August the 16th, 2017. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King. We are heard each Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, on the Internet at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and on WBAI-FM, 99.5 New York, on the radio, and the program is live stream on the Internet at WBAI.org at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Podcast of the program is available on PRN.FM, WBAI.org, and our website, PCRadioshow.org. When WBAI is in a membership drive, a replacement program may be scheduled on WBAI, but the regular program of the Personal Computer Show will continue on PRN.FM. We have a great show for you tonight. We have in the news new guidelines from the NIST on the creation of passwords, the Consumer Report on removal of recommendation of Microsoft Surface laptops and tablets, it is flawed. NASA is chasing the solar eclipse in two jet planes. And Android malware secretly records audios and pictures. And for feature segments, we have wearable and health technology by Dr. Alfred Poor. Topics covered: a no-drug alternative to opioid painkillers. Smartphones reveal insights into population obesity worldwide. And gold can be used for ultra-thin, flexibly breathable sensors and conductors for wearable devices on the skin. From the Tech Corner, that's me, Hank Key, the first computer music festival held in 1978 at Philadelphia. Where's the internet speed? Where's the speed and where's the beef? Domain website renewal alert. Marty Winston will talk about the direct connect of the Ethernet line also requires surge protection. Well, let's get started. New guidelines from the NIST on creation of passwords. Back in 2003, as a mid-level manager at the National Institute of Standards and Technology, Bill Burr was the author of the NIST special publication, 8-page primer, advising people to protect their accounts by inventing awkward new words, using obscure characters, capital letters, and numbers, and to change them regularly for passwords. The document became a sort of a guideline, and it became a go-to guide for federal agencies, universities, and large companies looking for a set of password-setting rules to follow. The problem is the advice ended up largely incorrect. Mr. Burrow says, change your password every 90 days. Most people make minor changes that are easy to guess. He laments that having obscure characters in the password doesn't keep the hacker at bay. Also off the mark, demanding a letter, a number, uppercase letter, special characters, such as an exclamation point or question mark, it doesn't work. In June, a special publication of the NIST standard has gotten rid of these password commandments. Paul Grassi, an NIST standards and technology advisor, who led the two-year effort, did a do-over, and the group thought at the outset that the document would require only a light edit. We ended up starting from scratch, Mr. Grassi said. Mr. Grassi said those rules did little for security. They actually had a negative impact on usability. Long, easy-to-remember phrases now get the nod over crazy characters, and users should be forced to change passwords only if there is a change they may have been stolen. Academics who have studied passwords says using a series of four words can be harder for hackers to crack than a shorter hodgepodge of strange characters, since having a large number of letters make things harder than a smaller number of letters, characters, and numbers. Mr. Burr, who once programmed Army mainframe computers during the Vietnam War, had wanted to base his advice on real-world password data. But back in 2003, there just wasn't much to find, and he said he was under pressure to publish guidance quickly. He asked the computer administrators at NIST if they would let him have a look at the actual passwords on their network. They refused to share them, he said, citing privacy concerns. They were appalled that I even asked them, Mr. Burrow said. With no empirical data on computer password security, Mr. Burrow leaned heavily on a white paper written in the mid-1980s. Long before consumers bought DVDs and cat food online. The published guidelines were the best he could do. In the end, it was probably too complicated for a lot of people to understand very well, and the truth is, it was barking up the wrong tree. Nevertheless, NIST's password advice became widely influential, not just within the federal government, but on corporate networks, websites, and mobile devices.
The biggest argument against Mr. Burroughs' prescription was that they haven't worked well at all. It just drives people bananas, and they don't pick good passwords no matter what they do. The past decade has seen a data breach boom. Hackers have stolen and posted online hundreds of millions of passwords from companies such as MySpace, LinkedIn, and Gawker Media. Those postings have given researchers the data they needed to take a hard look at how people's passwords fare against a flood of hackers. Their conclusion? While we may think our passwords are clever, they're not. We tend to gravitate towards the same old combinations over and over. Back in 2003, Mr. Burr didn't have the data to understand the phenomenon. Today, it is obvious that people can now better understand what should be used. The NIST rules were supposed to give us randomness. Instead, they spawned a generation of widely used and goofy-looking passwords. It really didn't work at all, and now they have new guidelines. Consumer Report on removal of recommendation of Microsoft Surface laptops and tablets is flawed. Last week, Consumer Report issued a statement in which they are removing their recommended designation from four Microsoft laptops, and they cannot recommend any other Microsoft laptops or tablets because of poor predicted reliability in comparison with other brands. The press statement on their website refers to breakage rate, which means hardware. Yet, when Consumer Report released a statement, cable news networks included software problems. This only contributes to the credibility of the report. The Consumer Report survey is based on the reporting of 90,741 laptops and tablets. There is no breakdown on how many responses of the 90,741 were subscribers owning a Microsoft laptop or tablet. The survey study is greatly flawed. Combining tablets and laptops is like combining the Toyota Yaris with the Toyota Avalon to determine overall quality and reliability. Microsoft disagrees based their own data on the Surface. Consumer Report is looking at laptops and tablets, and Microsoft is basing their findings on just the Surface laptop. They disagree. Microsoft is only looking at laptops. They're not communicating on the same frequency channel. The difference is not about the same thing. There are laptops, and there are laptops in which the screen is removable, and there are laptops in which the screen folds under. This class of equipment should be treated separate from standard laptops, as the hinge is not a factor in use. Laptop and tablets are not the same in platform use. There are manufacturers who do not sell tablets. Conversely, there are tablet manufacturers who do not sell notebooks. Microsoft disagreed with the findings, saying that the percentage of Surface return for repair is significantly lower than what is significantly lower when it's compared to the total number of units shipped. I personally would not accept the Consumer Report recommendations as absolute. They need to go back to the lab for more accurate reporting of available data. If you were thinking of buying one today, should you just go and buy it? No, I would hold off and wait and see if more data is coming out, but the way that Consumer Report is reporting, I don't consider it a complete report at this time. Now, how many have you relied on Consumer Report before making a big purchase? I'm no different from you. Where I know my subject, I often disagree with their findings. I recently needed to get a new clothes dryer. I bought the clothes dryer based on recommendations from Consumer Report, but I often disagree with them on subjects I feel I have more knowledge. Their recommendations are based on a point system. No weights are given to factors used in the evaluation. It should be separated. If the criteria is part of the study and I have no need for it, I would like to be able to deduct that from the report and come up with a review that matches more closely my needs. NASA's chasing the solar eclipse. Well, coming up is August 21st. That's when the solar eclipse will occur, which last happened 99 years ago. There's an eclipse coming, and even with the best possible planning, you won't be able to see it for longer than 2 minutes and 40 seconds. That's the maximum amount of time the moon's shadow will be visible, overlapping the sun from directly in the eclipse path, which stretches all the way across the continental United States. Scientists from Southwest Research Institute working in cooperation with NASA, well, they plan to monitor the eclipse continuously for much longer than that. How? Well, they rigged a pair of jets with telescopes to chase the eclipse. To make the planes into mobile observatories, the researchers will be able to track the eclipse as it moves across the Earth. NASA already had the perfect aircraft to make it happen, too. The high-altitude WB-57F is used for the agency to capture images of cloud formations and study climate, but now two of them have been repurposed for airborne astronomy. Amir Caspi, a solar astrophysicist with Southwest Research Institute, is leading the project for the rare eclipse. The jets will fly 70 miles apart, placing them at each edge of the total eclipse that runs from Oregon to South Carolina. The jets, however, are launching from NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston. They'll meet up with the eclipse 50,000 feet above Missouri and will keep with it as it passes over Illinois and Tennessee. The telescopes observing the eclipse are